Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The United States has been fighting its war on drugs for more than three decades now. It has cost at least $500 billion and put hundreds of thousands of people in prison. And there is virtually nothing to show for it. Veteran drug warriors say the latest offensive, a $1.4 billion Plan Mexico, is just as likely to fail. But there is a better way, these experts say. This hour, On Point, how America lost the drug war and where we go from here. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Ben Wallace Wells. He is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, and his long and fascinating story, How America Lost the War on Drugs, appears in the current issue. Ben, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So put this conversation into perspective for us. How did the phrase war on drugs come about?
Well, it came about during the Nixon administration. And one of the kind of paradoxes of the early years of the drug war is that while Nixon sort of launched the kind of pitted racial politics and culture war dependent sort of political frame that you know, gave us the law and order politics of the Reagan years and the sort of Republican Party during that time, he himself was pretty open-minded on drug policy. He had a commission that recommended the decriminalization of marijuana, for instance. But, you know, during that period, there was a sense that the kind of 60s combined with the problems of the inner city had gotten out of control, and there was a need for, you know, a kind of concerted federal effort to combat it.
So it was sort of a cultural astonishment, if you will, the hippie revolution, coupled with the fact that a lot of the soldiers were coming home from Vietnam, as you say in your article, with drug habits. Was that the sense?
Yeah, Vietnam was really a really catalytic moment early on. You know, both marijuana and heroin were obviously grown in Southeast Asia, very cheap. You know, the environment over there was not, you know, conducive to psychological stability. And, you know, so there were members of the military establishment in Congress who went over there and, you know, just came back astonished and warned that a whole generation of soldiers was going to return to the United States with drug habits of a level that we hadn't seen in this country before.
So you mentioned marijuana. What were the drugs of the biggest concern then?
Marijuana was the most prevalent, as it continues to be. But the thing that freaked people out was basically heroin. I mean, you know, there, mm-hmm. there had been for, 40 years a you know, sort of small but growing number of heroin users in this country. And the worry was that that might explode out of control.
So get us into your story then, Ben. You start your piece with this incredible tale of the capture of Pablo Escobar, who's the Colombian drug kingpin, of course, who was killed in 1993. Pick it up from there.
Well, one of the things that's sort of striking about that moment, as you go back and report through it and talk to the DEA agents and the, you know, drug policy folks who are intimately involved in trying to grab Escobar, was that there was an enormous optimism about the possibility of the drug war at that time. You know, there was this guy, this big, fat, you know, drug kingpin sitting down in Medellin who, you know, did control an enormous amount of the cocaine that was flooding into the United States, and at that point, at sort of the tail end of the crack epidemic, seemed to be himself responsible for you know, an enormous amount of social problems.
So tell the story, though, Ben. Tell the story of this guy being gunned down and the agents going in and what they found.
So when agents went into to the sort of prison that Escobar had been permitted to build for himself, they found shelves and shelves, you know, and this prison wasn't a conventional prison. It was basically an apartment.
Right.
One of the rooms in this apartment had been set up as an office. It had fax machines and you know, early cell phones and things like this. And they found shelves and shelves of binders. And the binders were filled with DEA reports and other government documents that documented in huge detail the efforts of the United States to capture Escobar. And so Escobar had you know, documents which disclosed who the informants were within his organization. They disclosed who the people in the Colombian military were, who the United States trusted and who they didn't trust. And the reason he'd been able to accumulate all of this evidence was that whenever his sort of lieutenants were captured in the United States, they never pled guilty. They always went to trial. And the DEA folks and the federal prosecutors who were, you know, involved in trying to put them in jail had always been puzzled by this. After Escobar's death, when they walked in and they saw these shelves and shelves of binders, they realized that what Escobar had been doing had been, you know, using these lieutenants as intelligence gatherers. And in the sort of discovery process, the normal legal processes of a criminal court case in the U.S., they were able to gain access to enormous amount of evidence about, you know, how they'd been captured and how the case against them had been mm-hmm. built. And through that, Escobar was able to, you know, discover an incredible amount about our efforts to get him.
In fact, in the piece, you quote a drug agent who said, essentially, Escobar knew so much more about what we were doing than we knew about what he was doing.
Yeah, that's not just the drug agent. That's the associate director of operations for the DEA at the time, John Coleman, you know, a really senior figure. This was kind of a stunning revelation for people, you know, who were out to get Escobar, just how sophisticated this operation was and how successful it had been.
So here we are in this moment of time and they've got this figured out, right? There's sort of the sense of triumph. There's an end game here. We can move forward, right? And we can catch these guys at their own game.
A total triumph, you know, and just about everybody involved at that time, people who are on the ground in Bogota, people at the National Security Council, are just sort of jumping up and down and celebrating, popping champagne with Colombian police and saying, you know, my God, you know, we've been down here in Colombia for 12 years. We've been slogging it out. You know, finally, maybe we've really broken through and we've lopped the head off. And they had lopped the head off. The problem was other heads grew back.
And what were they?
Well, they were competitor organizations. Very quickly, the American agents in Colombia discovered that, you know, some of the groups that had been out to get Escobar, that had been, you know, sort of paramilitary groups or quasi-governmental groups, had in fact been infiltrated and in many cases funded by the Cali cartel, which was at the time Escobar's group's main competitor. And so, you know, there had been this really extensive infiltration of the Colombian police and government. And so, you know, the next thing that we had to do in like 94, 95, as we readjusted, was to go after the Cali cartel, which was, you know, had sort of taken over and was now responsible for shipping an enormous amount of the cocaine up into the United States.
But in a broader picture, sort of explain to us, Ben, what this story proves as it relates to the war on drugs.
I think as you went through the 90s and as you kind of reconstruct it historically, you see a series of attempts to go overseas and cut cocaine off at the source. You know, we're going to go down there and put our hands around the neck of the guy who's responsible for all this. And once we get him, you know, no matter how expensive it is, you know, we can cinch this. You know, then we can finally end it. And again, you know, the trade proved a little bit more robust and a little bit more nimble than that. And so it's been enormously difficult for us to claim permanent successes in keeping the supply of particularly cocaine down, even though there are very, you know, very flashy momentary successes.
You talk about that difficulty in maintaining successes. If you take us back for just a moment to the 80s, to the mid-80s, when crack was leaching out of New York and L.A. and Miami into the American heartland. And explain to us how the government at that point reacted.
This was sort of the product of all that. There was this, you know, attempt to, you know, to go down and chase the supply in Colombia. There was also, you know, an effort to just sort of lock everybody up. And this was an effort that, you know, in retrospect, you can sort of understand, you know, there are real, you know, cities were really, really devastated. And so there was a sort of panic and they adopted these things called mandatory minimums, which put, federal mandatory minimums, which put people who had been arrested for possession of crack or possession in prison for many multiples of the amount of time that people arrested for similar amounts of cocaine possession or trafficking were put in prison for.
Hundreds of thousands of Americans, in fact, were jailed for those drug offenses under those laws.
Yeah.
And during that time also, there was sort of a moral conviction to tackle this. The Nancy Reagan line, you know, just say no. Explain that course.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and not just with Nancy Reagan, but this is something that really elevated under George H.W. Bush with Bill Bennett. You know, there was this kind of confluence of politics and reality at that point, where, you know, where you had a real kind of moral charge. You know, drugs were really bad. There was a morally corrosive effect, was the phrase that kept being used, that these drugs were having on cities and on people around the country. And so there was a moral charge to damp down on this stuff as well.
A moral charge and a doubling of spending on the drug war, up to $12 billion at that point, with expensive weaponry and all of that. But you point out in your piece that the long-term studies needed to show what would actually reduce drug use didn't exist.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the crack epidemic did many things. And one thing it did was it really catalyzed, sort of academics. And it sent people out into the field to try to figure out, you know, what in the heck we could do to, you know, actually begin to solve this problem. But by 1990, 1991, as the Bush administration really amped up spending, we didn't really know what would work and what didn't. We were sort of, you know, we were sort of moving ahead kind of blind.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the war on drugs and what our drug warriors and researchers and local cops have learned over the last 35 years. My guest this hour is Ben Wallace Wells. He is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, and his article, How America Lost the War on Drugs, appears in the current issue. So, Ben, before the break, you were talking about the period of time in the 1980s when we were sort of going blind into the drug war.
Right.
And then at some point we started to understand sort of what was going on. So how and when did we start to get it?
Just around the same time that Escobar died and around the same time that the Clinton administration came into power, in about 1993, there were some studies that were that began to come back from the field, and particularly influential were a series of studies that were done by the RAND Corporation, which had been this kind of, you know, Strangelove era defense think tank that, you know, as the Cold War ended, was moving into trying to use those same methods of mathematical modeling to figure out how we could solve social problems. And they went through and broke down sort of the effectiveness of every dollar spent in, you know, both what are called supply-side programs, which seek to, you know, reduce the amount of cocaine coming into the United States, and demand-side programs, which seek to, you know, either through putting people in jail or through drug treatment, to reduce the demand for drugs within the United States. And what they found surprised them. They had expected to go in and figure out that the Andean programs, you know, those which, you know, sent cops and military to stop coca growing and supply at its source would be the most effective. That sort of made sense. What they found, in fact, was those were far from the most effective. Far and away, the thing that was most cost effective and would do the most to reduce both drug consumption within the United States and sort of serious drug problems was drug treatment. And treatment is not perfect, you know, but if you could. But it has an effectiveness rate of about 13%. 13% of hardcore drug users who you put through treatment once are no longer hardcore drug users.
So you talk about this in your article, that Lee Brown, who was appointed by Bill Clinton to sort of head the drug war during that time, was the one who sort of realized that it was drug treatment, that you couldn't arrest your way out of this problem. You couldn't go to the source and tackle it there. That drug treatment was not a magic bullet, but it worked.
And Lee Brown had come to this through, you know, 30 years of frustration. He'd been a cop in Oakland and Houston and New York, you know, for years upon years, and had tried for a quarter century to arrest his way out of the problem. And by, you know, by the early 90s, when he was police commissioner in New York, before he was appointed by Clinton to be drug czar, he was banging his head against the wall and saying, this is ridiculous. And so by the time these RAND studies began to emerge in 1993, 1994, Brown was in a perfect position as drug czar to implement them.
But convincing the American government to shift gears then at this point and follow perhaps a different path proved to be very difficult.
It proved to be beyond Lee Brown's powers, yeah. There was sort of a moment in 1994, right before Republicans won control of the House, when drug policy scholars look back and say, you know, that could have been a pivot point. That could have been a moment when policy grew more progressive. But Brown had a very difficult time convincing Congress to follow. This was a moment when, you know, law and order, much more than it is now, was just a very necessary political stance, or a lot of politicians felt that way. And they were extremely leery of you know, appearing soft on crime by saying, you know, to hell with the military and the Andes. Let's put all these guys in drug treatment. And, you know, so there was a missed opportunity there. And then after 1994 and the Republican election in Congress, the landscape really changed. And the Clinton administration in particular sort of began to back away from Lee Brown. Leon Panetta, who was chief of staff at the time, told me that, you know, that there was a sense that the politics were just too tough for this. And so... So they ended up getting rid of him.
And so then take us to the point of a familiar face in the drug war, General Barry McCaffrey, who was this charismatic four-star general who became drug czar. What did he do?
Well, McCaffrey did a lot of things. The first thing he did was he really raised the profile. You know, right. Brown had been a sort of shy and retiring guy. McCaffrey was on television all the time, you know. And he wasn't a naive. He had been the commander of SOUTHCOM, the United States Southern Command, and as such had been, you know, the sort of end game oversight for a lot of the stuff that we were doing in the Andes. So, you know, he came in with a sort of open mind, and he didn't think at the time that what we were doing was working very perfectly.
But you also say in your piece that he took the drug war in a direction that had little obvious connection with actually preventing drug use. How so?
Well, there were a couple of things that he became very, very sort of animated by over the course of his of his tenure as drug czar, which is sort of the last half of the Clinton administration. The first was the Partnership for a Drug-Free America, the nonprofit group that had been producing all of these ads, you know, this is your brain on drugs, since the 1980s.
Right.
I had a meeting with a guy named Jim Burke, who was at the time the head of the partnership, who showed him a chart that, you know, that showed that As the presence of anti-drug ads on television had declined over the course of the 1990s, which they had, largely due to the rise of cable,
right,
the number of drugs consumed by Americans went up. It was a very crude chart, but it was very catalytic for McCaffrey, and so he decided to launch an initiative to use government dollars to get these anti-drug ads and more sophisticated anti-drug ads back on the air. The other studies he was very became very moved by were those that purported to show that marijuana acted as a gateway drug, that kids who used marijuana during their adolescence were much more likely to end up using harder drugs. Those subsequent studies have shown the studies which were prevalent at that time, which showed that into, you know, a more skeptical light. We're not really sure that that's how it works. But nevertheless, McCaffrey was very persuaded by this.
Was he effective?
And so, I'm sorry?
Was he effective?
McCaffrey?
Yeah.
No. It's hard to see ways in which McCaffrey was particularly effective. One thing he also did was he sort of launched this whole campaign against medical marijuana. There were all these, you know, initiatives going on, particularly in Western states, to legalize the use of marijuana for medicinal purposes, which was really a kind of ancillary issue. You know, this is, you know, just sort of a secondary thing. It wasn't causing, you know, the problems on the level of crack or methamphetamine or something like that, obviously. Mm-hmm. But he was animated by this whole sensibility that, you know, light drug use led to really problematic drug use, and any drug use ought to be, you know, sort of combated at the start. It was this maximalist approach. Mm-hmm. And so much of the last few years of his tenure were sort of wrapped up in chasing, cancer patients who were, you know, trying to get medical pot
prescribed.
Medical
marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This history is so interesting, Ben, and I want to get more of it, but I want to also welcome a caller into the conversation at this point. From Medford, Massachusetts, Jack is on the line. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
My name is Jack Cole, as you heard, and I'm a retired state police officer, 26 years, with 14 years undercover in narcotics. And today I run an organization called LEAP, or Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. It's an international nonprofit educational organization with 9,000 members, including police chiefs, judges, prosecutors, prison wardens, DEA, FBI agents. Hmm. And we're all calling for an end to this bloody war on drugs, because we know that if we ended drug prohibition, like we ended alcohol prohibition in 1933, as law enforcers, we know the next morning Al Capone and all his smuggling buddies were out of business. They were off our streets. They were no longer out there killing each other, cops, or our children in crossfire and drive-by shooting. And then if we regulate those drugs, we know we can keep them out of the hands of our children, who, by the way, have said in every government survey for the last 10 years that it's easier for them to buy illegal drugs than it is to buy beer and cigarettes. Of course, the reason for that is they get carded if they go to buy beer and cigarettes. We could also stop overdose deaths by regulating the drugs, because people don't die of an overdose because they shoot more and more dope. They die because they don't know how much of that little package of powder they're buying is really the drug and how much is the cutting agent. Too much drug, you're dead.
So drug prohibition seems to be the answer for Jack. Jack, thanks for your call. Ben Wallace Wells, what do you think about that?
I think that, you know, that's certainly an opinion that's out there. I think that many drug policy researchers would say that there's an intermediary step which hasn't been tried, which is, you know, far short of legalizing cocaine, why don't we just try, you know, emphasizing things that work, like drug treatment and, you know, targeted law enforcement in our policy, and not things that are not proven to work. And why don't we see, you know, how far we can get with a sort of more modest reform like that.
Mm-hmm. Another call now to Brockton, Massachusetts, and Brandon, who's on the line. Hi, Brandon.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on your show, because I was very involved in drugs when I was in high school, which was only a short 3 years ago. I just remember seeing drugs being so available to everyone, and I ended up being a heroin addict for a couple of years. Mm. And I just remember in high school just seeing how available drugs were, whether they were pills or marijuana or anything, you know. I mean, just the school was flooded with drugs, and here I am thinking, my government says that we are fighting a war on drugs, and here we are in school, and we can buy basically whatever we want.
And you can't see it. Brandon, thanks so much for your call. Ben Wallace Wells, you know, you hear people like Brandon,
yeah,
and our last caller. You know, a lot of people are wondering what the answer is. If we've done so many bad things and we sort of traveled down the wrong paths, what is the answer?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know if anybody has a single answer, and I suspect there isn't a single answer. And you know, I think that a kind of quest for simplicity in this kind of policy can be as problematic as a quest for maximalism. The issue to me is again, you know, there are certain things we know work. There are certain things we know don't work. Let's, you know, why don't we just sort of focus on what does work for a little while and see how far that gets us? I would say, you know, that though what measures we have of drug use are very, very crude in this country, even the best measures the government has are not particularly precise at estimating the amount of people who use drugs in a, you know, given year or month, or, you know, on a sort of ongoing hardcore basis, there isn't very much evidence that we've been able to really reduce the amount of sort of harder drugs that are used in this country. And so if you look at this whole span of history and policy over, you know, a quarter century, a little more, you know, you do start to wonder, you know, what have we gotten for all the money we've put in? You know, there's a whole lot of churn, and we sort of shift from drug to drug, and, you know, there's an inertia, a lot of things are happening. And yet, you know, it's really hard to discern a huge outcome at the end of the day.
There was such an interesting section of your piece, Ben, where you speak to the connection between drugs and violence. And
yeah,
you cite the work of David Kennedy, who's a Harvard criminologist who pioneered the Boston Gun Project. Tell us a little bit about what that is and what his thinking is.
Well, David Kennedy is a really interesting figure in sort of the current fight against drugs. He's a guy who studies the ways in which crime evolve, in particularly in urban settings. And he's come over the course of 20 years of study in this to a theory that kind of argues that if you can change the way that you police, you can separate out drug crime that is actually problematic from drug crime that you can actually live with. In a series of very, you know, urban, very high poverty settings, he's been able, as a consultant to police departments, to help police departments find new ways to separate those out and to, you know, while, you know, if not openly permitting, at least acknowledging that you know, the drug trade will continue, to be able to tamp down on violent crime.
So tell us at the grassroots level exactly what happens, because it's so interesting.
So, you know, what will happen is, this is an ongoing project in High Point, North Carolina, that we described that does this. Police officers will go into a neighborhood that is known as, you know, a high-volume crack neighborhood, and they will spend a month sort of staking out an area where there's a lot of, you know, a lot of overt drug dealing. And then they'll document each of the, you know, young guys or older guys who are involved in this. They'll call them all into a room, you know, a community center, a police station, and they'll, you know, they'll show them videos that show each of them, you know, committing felonies. And there'll be a prosecutor there who, you know, sort of says that, you know, each of, you know, we've got
right,
each of you,
right,
basically.
So they bring these folks into a room, and then what happens?
And then they say, you know, but we're not going to prosecute you for this. You know, we've been putting
right,
kids in jail for many years, and we know this isn't working. What we want to say to you is, you know, we want you out of the overt drug business. You know, we want you to sort of stop, you know, stop selling on the street, stop selling in crack houses, stop selling in these ways that, you know, encourage all sorts of sort of social problems. You know, Kennedy and the police departments that sort of do this work say that, you know, in a perfect world, they would obviously love if no drugs were sold. But the Kennedy says there are an enormous amount of drugs sold and dealt in the suburbs every day, and the sort of, you know, the secondary social problems just don't come about there.
So essentially, what they're saying to these kids on the street who are packing their guns and dealing the drugs is, we know who you are and who you run with, and if you don't stop, we're going to arrest every last one of you. And essentially, what David Kennedy has found is the violence stops.
Yeah, they can get them to stop, and you know, in city after city, the results have been pretty impressive. And anyway, it's a fascinating project.
So it's a myth in some ways that violence is linked to the drug trade.
I don't know if it's exactly a myth, but I think that you know, what Kennedy has showed is that there are ways that the two can be separated.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the war on drugs and how, after 35 years and $500 billion, the prisons are full of young men and drugs are still a fact of life. My guest this hour has been Ben Wallace Wells, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. And I want to bring in another voice into the conversation now. Joining us from New Orleans is Ethan Brown. He's the author of a new book called Snitch: Informants, Cooperators, and the Corruption of Justice. Great to have you with us, Ethan.
Thanks for having me.
So, as you know, there was a big ruling this week at the U.S. Supreme Court related to drugs and criminal sentencing. I wondered if you'd help us explain the significance of that in relation to our conversation here.
Right. Well, the Supreme Court ruling this week was a split decision involving two cases. One was a crack cocaine case. The other one was a case involving an ecstasy dealer. And in this ruling, the court ruled overwhelmingly 7-2 that federal judges are free to make lower sentences than what the sentencing guidelines mandate.
And then there was another decision, the United States Sentencing Commission. Tell us about that.
Right. The Sentencing Commission had proposed earlier this year somewhat lower sentences for crack cocaine related offenses. By law, those those proposed guidelines had to be rejected by Congress or they would be simply established. Congress did not reject the new guidelines. Mm-hmm. They went into effect. And then the Sentencing Commission voted upon the issue of whether or not to make those guidelines retroactive to the approximately 19,000 prisoners who are currently incarcerated under the old guidelines, and they voted to indeed make those sentences retroactive.
So you had an interesting illustration from that recent decision of the Sentencing Commission related to the problem that we've been discussing this hour, and I wonder if you'd share it with us.
Right. Well, you know, the big thesis of my book is essentially that, you know, since the establishment of the federal sentencing guidelines, particularly for drug-related offenses in the mid to late 80s, a very specific part of the guidelines is called Section 5K1.1 of the guidelines, and that provides for extraordinary benefits for those who cooperate in drug cases, specifically big sentencing reductions. And this has created, I believe, a kind of cottage industry of defendants who falsely implicate others and who offer all sorts of testimony that goes uncorroborated in the courtroom. And one interesting facet of this recent decision by the Sentencing Commission to make those sentences retroactive is that when the commission held its hearings to make this decision this week, a bunch of families who had relatives incarcerated under the old guidelines were there and you know, very hopefully watching the proceedings, and a front page Washington Post piece about some of these families mentioned a couple of the cases, and in most of the cases cited, the defendants in question had been convicted solely on the basis of cooperator testimony. Hmm. It was fascinating.
So essentially what you're saying is we've created a system that uses the most hardcore offenders as essentially informers,
right,
who are turned right back to the streets, and it's the minor offenders who are going to prison for long periods of time under the mandatory minimum sentencing.
Right, and actually in one specific case mentioned in this Washington Post piece, a pair of brothers from Washington, D.C. were convicted in a big crack case. And they were convicted basically solely based on testimony from a cooperator, and this particular cooperator actually happened to be the ringleader of the operation. The ringleader of the operation received something like a 3-year sentence, while these two brothers from D.C., who by the federal government's own estimation were sort of peripheral members of this organization, received something like 19 years in prison.
Hmm. So what's your basic theory, Ethan, about what went wrong in the past in the war on drugs?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting to, you know, to go all the way back to the early 70s and, you know, to the Nixon era and trace some of the changes that have happened over the past few decades. But to me, things really started going wrong with the passage of the mandatory minimums in the mid to late 80s. And you know, it's critical that people know that, you know, even, you know, objective criminal justice policy experts have said that these mandatory minimums were not based on any kind of sound science about crack cocaine. They were not even given really any debate or consideration in Congress when they were passed. Hmm. One person who I spoke to while writing my book said that the mandatory minimums, the whole process had, quote, the speed of an auction. It was who can be the toughest on this issue. Hmm. And I think, you know, from the mid to late 80s onward until now is also when you see this explosive growth in prisons. So I think that, you know, we've been fighting the drug war since the early 70s, but it was ratcheted up to a point of that is really just extraordinary from the mid to late 80s onward. Mm.
Let's go to the phones now and take some more calls, introduce some more voices to our conversation. St. Matthews, South Carolina is where Kevin is. Hi, Kevin.
How you doing, Jane?
Hi. Thank
you for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a couple of points I'd like to make.
Sure.
First thing, the reason crack cocaine, the reason people use crack cocaine is because it's cheap. Rich people can afford powder cocaine, and rich people all over this country using it doesn't cause a problem. But I'm 48 years old. I never have even took a hit off a joint. I've never used any kind of drugs. But what they need to do is, I would go a step further than even legalizing it. What they need to do is, instead of spending $5 billion on all this fighting and killing and just not working, because you can get crack on any street corner. Even here in South Carolina, we're a little small rural state, but you can get crack anywhere. Mm-hmm. And they could take that money. They should go straight to the cartels and buy the cocaine, bring it up here, and have it at places like distribution places, and mm-hmm. give it to people that need it. And that would do away with all the peripheral crime. They wouldn't have any reason to steal to get it.
Well, it's an interesting thought, Kevin. I'm gonna turn that to Ben Wallace Wells and ask you what your response might be.
You know, in the Nixon administration actually contemplated doing something exactly like that. Pat Moynihan, who was at the time, a domestic policy advisor to Nixon, floated a plan that said, what if the U.S. just bought up all the poppy in the world, bought up the world's whole supply of poppy, put it in a warehouse somewhere, and sort of cut this off at its source? That, for political reasons, that never got very far.
Yeah,
and it
I
seems
guess
to
not.
Me, you know, right. seems to me sort of tactically problematic today. But I do think that, you know, that you do hear a lot of, you know, kind of ideas from ordinary people that have that kind of mm-hmm. element of radical reform. And I think that suggests that maybe something is kind of generally off. I'd also say on the Sentencing Commission decision, one of the things that was striking to me about the Supreme Court decision was that it was 7-2. And this is a pretty conservative court right now.
Right.
And so that sort of suggested to me that, even among conservatives, there is a pretty profound rethinking of at least this element of the drug war, of at least the discrepancy between crack and powder cocaine. That, as Ethan said, has been sort of a really problematic development over the last 20 years.
Ethan Brown, I want you to respond to what our caller had to say. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, the caller actually made a couple of interesting points. One is there's a bunch of research now, particularly by a pair of researchers named John Calkins and Peter Reuter, about drug prices and drug availability. And what's been really interesting to me is, we still think of cocaine as sort of the rich man's drug, but actually the price of cocaine has declined fairly steadily over the past 20 years. And, at the same time, the availability of drugs has remained fairly consistent. So, these are sort of critical ways to me to gauge the effectiveness of the drug war. And if the price of drugs is lower and the purity of drugs is higher and the availability of drugs is somewhat the same, then I think, we can fairly objectively judge the drug war as a failure.
Ethan Brown joining us from New Orleans, author of the just-released book, Snitch, Informants, Cooperators, and the Corruption of Justice. Ethan, great to have you on. Thanks for your
Thank
perspectives.
You.
Back to the phones now. Bill is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Well, thank you.
I'm calling to balance out some of the drug users that have been calling.
Okay, good. Give us your perspective.
My perspective, I think before we legalize drugs and have all the problems of that, we need to try drug testing. Choke it off at the source. Test every high school student, test every adult as they come up for their driver's license renewals.
Hmm.
Drug users, once they're convicted, permanent parole, where they have to be tested periodically to make sure that they're off drugs. I think that's something we should try before we, in fact, I would substitute it for all the drug interdiction money we're spending.
Hmm. Bill?
I think that the problem is not so much that... people need to get legalized drugs. It's more they need to stop using drugs. It costs us money in 100 different ways.
Well, thanks so much, Ben Wallace Wells. What do you think of Bill's idea of drug testing all over the place?
There are a couple of different points. One is that one thing that's been very attractive to drug policymakers recently has been the notation that an enormously high proportion of the hardcore illicit drugs that are used in this country, something like 60%, are used by people who are either on probation or parole. Mm. That suggests that those people are a captive audience. You know, you have legal mechanisms to call them into an office and force them to urinate in a cup, and you know, see what they're using. And so there's been some pretty significant innovation that's begun to happen and is continuing to happen to try to develop programs to make drug testing more precisely effective and to kind of capture that captive population. It's an interesting project mm-hmm. in Hawaii right now. The second thing is this has actually become a kind of entrepreneurial boon. There are a lot of little companies out there that are trying to, to take advantage of new technologies and trying to manufacture, more complex and expensive drug kits that they can sell to the government, to parole boards, and to private companies. And, I think it's an interesting development. I'm not yet sure what will come of it, and it's still sort of at an infant stage, but there certainly is a lot of momentum for increased drug testing in all sorts of places.
So at this moment in time, Ben, as you well know, America is about to embark on a new billion-dollar plan to go after Mexican cartels. And I wonder what your perspective is on that and the consequences of repeating our past mistakes in this new venue.
Well, I think it's interesting. What we learned in Colombia, we've been trying a sort of similar thing in Colombia. We've put an enormous amount of money into what's called Plan Colombia from 2000 up to the present day to fund the Colombian military and police to go after coca growers and traffickers. We've also, included money for alternative development programs for coca growers that haven't panned out. The problem has been this money proved in Colombia to be enormously effective as a state building, as a state building program, as something that made the state more secure. Medellin today, people tell me, is something closer to Miami than what our fantasies of Medellin are. Mm. But it hasn't really done anything to damp down narcotics coming into this country. And I think the suspicion that I've seen from a lot of experts on Mexico and on drug policy is that we might be doing the same thing in Mexico. If you're thinking about this in terms of how do we ensure a more stable and less violent Mexico, this might be a successful project. Mm. If you're thinking of this in terms of how do we keep drugs from coming into this country, it's much less likely to be a successful mm. project.
Back to the phones, Janice now, who is calling from Boston. Hi, Janice.
Hi, Jane. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure.
I'm glad that friend brings up Colombia. I've just returned from working in Colombia for a year as a human rights observer. In my experience there is that although the cities, as Ben says, are more secure, the countryside is actually still very dangerous, and civilians continue to pay the price for the U.S.'s both drug policy and drug use. The U.S. government has pumped about $4 billion in the last 10 years into the Colombian government to fight drugs, and U.S. consumers pump about $30 to $50 billion a year into Colombia as a result of their drug use. What this has meant for Colombian civilians, specifically in the countryside, is that their lives are in danger. Mm. And I guess I'm calling today because I wanted to draw all of our attention to the human rights cost of this drug war and ask Ben whether he sees that there's any political will to change U.S. drug policy given all the failures that we're talking about today, and also ask about Americans' moral responsibility given the impact of our drug use and drug policy.
Terrific question, Janice. Thank you very much for your call. Ben?
In terms of momentum, I think there is some. I mean, I think that the mandatory minimum changes are enormously encouraging to people who want a sort of different take on the war on drugs. Those are, sort of very obvious and much complained about targets of ire over the last 15 years. And to see, a kind of, as I said before, a kind of, broader political consensus than we've seen in the past kind of come together with conservatives joining liberals to say this is a bad and has been a very problematic idea is a good sign. In Colombia, there has been some momentum within the newly democratic house to reduce the level of commitment that we've got down there. But there are complicating issues. There are trade deals going on with Colombia and so forth. I certainly agree, and my reporting certainly bore out most of what the caller talked about, you know, the human rights abuses that have gone on by a Colombian military and police that have been, you know, strengthened by our money have been well documented and problematic. And so, you know, generally, yes, there's momentum for reform. With regard to Colombia, the picture's a little less clear.
Ben Wallace Wells, contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. His fascinating story appears in this current issue, How America Lost the War on Drugs. So great to have you with us. Really interesting conversation. Thanks.
It's been fun to be here.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.